From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America presents Issues in the News. The nation's top Washington correspondents offer their perspectives on the week's major stories. Your moderator is Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Issues in the News begins now.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard, and joining me on the show this week are Barbara Slavin, Washington correspondent for AlMonitor.com and senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's South Asia Center, and Stephen Collinson, White House correspondent for Agence France-Presse. And here are the issues. Pressure is growing on Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki to allow the formation of a new government with more participation from the Sunni and Kurdish populations, and perhaps with a new prime minister. The United States, meanwhile, agreed to free up $600 million in aid to Egypt the day before the Egyptian government jailed three journalists. In Mississippi, African-American Democrats joined Republicans to nominate Senator Thad Cochran to a new six-year term and defeat a more conservative challenger to Cochran. And in Washington, President Obama's use of his executive power to override Congress has prompted House Republicans to challenge this practice in the federal courts. Well, I think, Barbara, Iraq's the big story, and there seems to be pressure, even in Maliki's own party, that something has to be done. And, of course, the background is that he's driven Sunnis and Kurds out of the government and, in many cases, tried to prosecute them, including his former vice president.
Yeah, this is a very ticklish moment. The U.S. is playing this very carefully. If you look at comments by Secretary of State John Kerry, he's not explicitly saying that Maliki should step aside and allow someone else to come in, but the operative adjective is inclusive. They're looking for an inclusive government, and that's a code word for Maliki should step aside.
Well, they've certainly leaked in Washington anyway that's one of their goals without being explicit.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose there is a way that Maliki could somehow try to bring in enough other people to make it look like an inclusive government, but he's really damaged and burned bridges with so many people. As you mentioned, he tried to arrest his vice president, who fled to Turkey. He's put out warrants against many of the other important Sunni figures. And it's very, very difficult, even, frankly, if there's another prime minister, to see how you put Iraq back together again. The other names that are being floated are all from the major Shiite parties. And, of course, the Shiites are a majority in Iraq, and they won the recent elections. But some of them are considered a little less polarizing than Maliki. I think a very important factor here will be how Iran views this. Maliki was chosen, in effect, by Iran and Zalmay Khalilzad, then our ambassador in Iraq in 2006, after protracted negotiations to get rid of a previous Shiite prime minister. And I think, again, it's going to be a combination of the U.S. with perhaps even a stronger voice by the Iranians, who, you know, let's face it, they are the patron for the Shia groups in Iraq.
Stephen, one of the few things that Republicans and Democrats agree on regarding Iraq is that Maliki is really the biggest problem, that he is more responsible than anybody else for putting Iraq in this situation where this relatively small, formerly allied with al-Qaeda group, is taking over the country. So how do you see the whole thing there?
Barbara's right. The participation of Iran is going to be very interesting in this. The question is, does Iran have any interest in what the U.S. says is an inclusive government? And will it matter that much who the next prime minister of Iraq is? Will he be able to rule in a way in which other parties, other sects of Islam and the Kurds will be able to take part in the country? So it may be that the underlying conditions in Iraq, the massive sectarianism, the bleed over from the war in Syria, have just as much to do with this as the fact that, you know, Maliki was found wanting as a leader. It's true that he did very little over the last 2.5 years since the departure of U.S. troops to reach out to the other communities, and he may have prepared the ground, if you like, for this advance. But the whole question of what's going to be left of Iraq after this is a much deeper one than just the personality of the man that's running the government.
Yeah, what is going to be left, Barbara?
Well, you know, it's certainly, at best, a country that is nominally still one country, but with, I think, a great deal of autonomy for all its regions. Mm. The Kurds already have that. They'll keep that and maybe get more. The Sunnis will presumably want their own autonomous region, and then you'll have a sort of Shiistan in the south. This was very much what Joe Biden proposed back in 2006, and he was sort of laughed out of the room by everybody, but that's what it's devolved into. There have been some interesting articles I've read recently suggesting that formally breaking up the country is not a solution because, first of all, it's not a neat division. You have Kurds, Sunni, Shia intermarried. There was a wonderful thing I saw on Twitter. It was a picture from Iraq of a Sunni man and a Shia woman, and in between their daughter, their beautiful young daughter, and, you know, one said, "I'm Sunni, I'm Shia," and the other, and the little girl said, "I'm sushi," and it was very cute. But you have a lot of sushis in Iraq and also in Syria, you know, people who have intermarried over the years, so it's not a neat division. And you have fights within communities, so you have certainly many Sunnis who despise ISIS. Mm-hmm. Who are secular and don't want to see their country taken over by these crazy fundamentalists. Mm-hmm. Within the Shia community, you have many divisions as well. So just, you know, cutting it up into three isn't a solution. Mm-hmm. But perhaps keeping the nominal boundaries, more autonomy, and mm-hmm. allowing important Sunni politicians, Kurdish politicians, mm-hmm. to participate in the central government, that's probably the only way to stop the fighting.
You know, the one group that seems to be doing awfully well are the Kurds. I've been to Kurdistan, and it's remarkably different from the rest of Iraq. For one thing, it's green. They're mountains, and it's much prettier than the rest of Iraq. But the Kurds, Stephen, still have this problem where it would be one thing if Iraq allowed them to become an independent state, but then that would merely anger the Turks and the Iranians and Syrians, who would be, where there are also Kurds living there who would want to be a part of this bigger state. And so the Kurds probably have it right now, being and having a considerable authority over their own territory, about as good as it's going to get for them.
That's right, and I think they're exploiting this meltdown of the rest of Iraq to try and sort of expand their footprint in the country. And they're often used as the exemplar by American and Western analysts of what Iraq could be if mm-hmm. a functioning democracy mm-hmm. were ever allowed to take root. The problem is you have this centuries-old conflict between Shia and Sunni Islam, which is a massive fault line, not just in Iraq, but mm-hmm. in Syria and mm-hmm. other places across the Middle East. So to some extent, they're sort of free of that issue. But as you said, with the whole issue of autonomy and statehood, if that were allowed to go ahead, it would just open up a new Pandora's box in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. So they're probably going to exploit their position, try and improve their position, but they're unlikely to get their ultimate ambition.
Barbara, I think I know what the American government wants, but I'm not sure exactly what the Iranians would like to have there. Obviously, they want to have influence, and they do. And they don't want ISIS to take over Iraq, Baghdad, for instance. But what is their goal there, do you think?
Well, there's a lot of anxiety in Iran right now about the situation. You have to remember that Iran and Iraq fought an 8-year war that killed 250,000 young Iranians. They're very worried about this group. I know you've read there have been stories about some alleged Iranian connection with al-Qaeda here or there, but, mm-hmm. you know, Iran does not support ISIS. Yeah. ISIS believes mm-hmm. that Shiites are apostates and mm-hmm. deserve to be killed if
and
they don't
killed a lot of
if
them.
if they don't convert to the Sunni version of right. Islam. Mm-hmm. So they're very concerned. I mean, their goals in Iraq have been to have a friendly government in power that is dominated by Shia, and to have relative stability in the country so they can do business.
Well, they've had the first.
You know, Iraq is an important trading partner yeah. for Iran mm-hmm. now. Mm-hmm. They've been providing electricity. They've been in cahoots in terms of smuggling some of their oil out and selling it through mm-hmm. Iraq, that sort of thing. And Iran also has important relations with the mm-hmm. Kurds and has mm-hmm. for a long time. Mm-hmm. So their interests are not very different from the American interests. Mm-hmm. And I know that makes people in Washington uncomfortable, but that's a fact.
Well, it makes me uncomfortable, but in any case, Stephen, here's the one question I still have not gotten a good answer for. How can I, look, I know the Iraq army is, in some cases, disintegrated literally, but how can this tiny, I mean, it's a relatively tiny force that ISIS has. I mean, how many people are there? I mean, 5, 6, 7, 8,000, something like that? I don't think it's much more than that, right. And yet they're marching through Iraq.
Right, I've heard some estimates up to sort of 10 or 12,000, but it's still small.
I mean, the Iraqi army was, what, 200,000 or 300,000 or something,
right.
supposedly.
One reason is they've been financed by wealthy supporters, private rich individuals in the Gulf. Another answer is that every time they've got a lot of money, every time they go into a town, they drain the treasury, they get all the cash. They can use that to buy arms to finance themselves. Mm-hmm. And another question is, you know, the whole idea of a unified Iraqi army perhaps was, we were too optimistic about it. Mm-hmm. The fact you could just build an army literally overnight or over the period of a few years, mm-hmm. in a country where ethnic and sectarian divisions are so deep, is, you know, perhaps we overestimated that, and people maybe need to look at that when they talk about building the Afghanistan army. Mm. Just one point on Iran is that when we talk about foreign policy from Washington, we tend to see foreign countries in a sort of a monolithic view. We do it a lot with China. We don't appreciate that there are also domestic political motivation in places like Iran. For example, the Obama administration has been talking about Iran to people like the foreign minister, Zarif, on the sidelines of these nuclear talks in Vienna. But I think there's a lot of, Barbara could tell you more about this than me, but there's a lot of questioning about who exactly controls Iran's policy towards Iraq, towards Syria, towards Lebanon. We've seen that the reports that the head of the Quds Force of the Revolutionary Guard has been in Iraq advising Maliki. At the same time as the US is sending advisors to Baghdad, Iran's sending military advisors to Baghdad. So, right.
And drones.
Right. So, yeah. You know, to me at least it's a little bit unclear exactly what Iran wants from Iraq and what leverage it will bring to bear to get the result it wants.
You know, Barbara, I assume the American advisors and the Iranian advisors don't meet with Maliki in the same meeting.
Yeah, I don't think they're going to the bar together, let's put it that way. But in answer to your question, I mean, this small group has been augmented by Baathist Sunni tribesmen, Iraqi Sunnis who are just furious at the Maliki government. That's mm-hmm. why they've been so successful. Also, the group uses terror tactics. They cut off people's heads, they put scary videos up, and they have momentum behind them. Mm-hmm. The Iraqi army that we left behind in 2011 has been described as largely a checkpoint army. They're good at checking people at checkpoints, but that's about it. Mm-hmm. They don't really know how to fight when threatened. And Iraq had a great army, which we destroyed, let's not forget. Mm-hmm. In 2003, one of the first acts of that brilliant man, Paul Bremer, note the sarcasm, was to formally dissolve the Iraqi army, which was one of the best fighting forces in the Middle East.
But it and was you Saddam cannot... Hussein's army.
It was his army, yes, but it was also the army that fought the Iranians and protected Iraq against the Iranians for 8 years. And to the extent Iraq had a national institution, it was that army. Most of the members of it were Shia. And the U.S. destroyed that army and said, oh, we can build a new one. Well, it's not so easy. All the generals, all the senior officers, Sunni and Shia, most of them were cast aside. And what you got was an army of Maliki's cronies, ex-militia people who had been trained in Iran, not people who necessarily had a great deal of formal military expertise that only comes from fighting real wars, like the old Iraqi army did.
Well, you certainly wound up with the way you described the army. It didn't start that way with U.S. advice. It was an army with a lot of Sunnis in it that Maliki got rid of. But anyway, that's a longer debate, and we don't have time for it. I've always been a defender of Paul Bremer, but he has a lot of conservative critics, too. It's not, he really does. Anyway, Egypt. Stephen, what if the Egyptians had, the day before the U.S. had planned to free up this $600 million or so, had jailed these journalists? It seems to me it would have been hard for the U.S. to go ahead and free up the money.
Right. John Kerry flew into Cairo this week. The U.S. is clearly looking for some new friends or old friends to come back in the Middle East, and everything that's happening everywhere else. The position of Egypt is again sort of rising in terms of its regional influence. So Kerry goes into Cairo. He meets the president. They have a meeting in which Kerry says that they're going to start the process of freeing up aid that was frozen, $600 million, and some Apache helicopters over the coup, basically, in Egypt to the overthrowing of the Muslim Brotherhood. This was followed by a massive crackdown on the Muslim Brotherhood by the al-Sisi administration. And Kerry made some encouraging noises. He said he believed that the government was beginning to consider respect for human rights, etc., etc. The next day he flew off, and three journalists who have been on trial for a long time from Al Jazeera were jailed for 7 and 10 years, respectively, including Peter Grester, an Australian, used to work for the BBC. It's got a massive amount of publicity. First of all, it was very embarrassing for John Kerry. Some of that kind of went below the radar because so much else is happening in the Middle East that I don't think it was noticed that much. And it once again raised the issue that the United States has consistently had with Egypt. It needs Egypt as a major Arab strategic ally, but much of what's going on in Egypt is counter to U.S. values, and the jailing of journalists is clearly counter to U.S. values. So it's unclear what happens next. The United States has called on the government to offer clemency to these journalists, to pardon them. A lot of people thought that the trial was, they'll go through the process of jailing these journalists and a little way down the track, quietly send him out of the country. It's not clear that that is going to happen. It remains to be seen if the president has the political leverage or maneuvering room to be able to do that. And meantime, these journalists are sitting in this jail in Cairo.
Barbara, do you think the Obama administration is a bit embarrassed?
Yeah, I think they are. But, you know, Egypt is really an absolutely mortifying problem, as Stephen said. You know, you can't completely cut off ties with this country. We need Egypt to maintain the peace treaty with Israel, to police the Sinai, and to work with the United States in counterterrorism efforts. But their behavior domestically has been very, very upsetting to many people in this country and certainly many people in Egypt. And I don't think it's a basis for long-term stability there.
Well, we're going to take a break here. I'm going to come back and ask at least one more question about Egypt. But first, a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News, coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard, and joining me on the show today are Barbara Slavin, Washington correspondent for AlMonitor.com and senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's South Asia Center, and Stephen Collinson, White House correspondent for Agence France-Presse. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com. Well, Barbara, let me follow up with that. Is there some alternative to a long-run American-Egyptian relationship?
I don't think so. I mean, there is still some money, several hundred million dollars, that's being held back, and that should continue to be held back. I think the U.S. is going to have to look for other ways to try to support civil society in Egypt. It's going to be very difficult, frankly, under the restrictions placed by the Egyptian government. Continue to press for the release of these journalists. There was no evidence presented against them for doing anything other than their jobs in covering the news and the unrest in Egypt.
Well, that was the problem.
You know, yeah.
The Egyptian government. They were doing their jobs.
It's very important that the United States project a view that the U.S. is not opposed to Islam and not opposed to people who are devout Muslims who want to express their views in a peaceful manner. And we can show this through our support for Tunisia, which is the only Arab Spring country where things actually seem to be turning out reasonably well, because the government is inclusive there. And, you know, they're not trying now to dominate the political scene in Tunisia. They've got a constitution. Things seem to be moving reasonably well. Beyond that, it's very confusing, talking about this a little bit earlier as I was coming in, that in the Middle East now it's hard to know who your friends are and who your enemies are. The table gets scrambled over and over. We've had a situation now where Bashar al-Assad's forces in Syria are bombing ISIS on the Iraq-Syria border. Now, we don't like Assad, and President Obama has said repeatedly that he must go, and yet he is bombing a group that the United States regards as a terrorist group and as our enemy. The Iranians are sending drones and Qasem Soleimani, the head of the Quds Force, into Iraq to bolster the Iraqi forces against ISIS. Iran is on our terrorism list, but they are acting against groups that are terrorists. So it's going to take a tremendous amount of flexibility and nuance, and a lot of this is just going to go way over the heads of the American people, who frankly don't understand and just look at the whole region. I thought it was funny that Jon Stewart of The Daily Show has revived an old logo of his, Mesopotamia. Mesopotamia. And that's what most Americans think when they look at the Middle East. They think it's a huge mess.
Well, it is a huge mess, among other things.
Right. I mean, you have, as Barbara was saying, you have United States ostensibly in Iraq on the same side as its enemies, Syria
and Iran.
And Iran. And, you know, work that one out and try and come up with a foreign policy that's consistent. The president's had a lot of criticism for his foreign policy in the Middle East, but I would challenge any of these challengers, the potential candidates in 2016, to draw sharper lines. I mean, it's one thing to draw lines, it's another thing to implement them. It's basically a real mess.
There was a funny exchange at the State Department briefing with the deputy spokesperson, Marie Harf, where Marie Harf said, "We welcome anyone in the region who is willing to stand up and help fight the threat that ISIL poses." And then, so the reporters say, "Anyone? You know, Syria, Iran?" And then she's floundering, and she says, "Well, if Assad were to stop killing his own people, we can have that discussion." But, you know, it's very, very hard to be consistent when it comes to dealing with problems that are this complicated.
Yeah, I'd hate to be a State Department spokesman at the at the moment. That would be quite hard. Well, let me turn to domestic policy, particularly let's start with Mississippi, where there was a Republican primary election in which black Democrats voted voted and turned out to be the pivotal group that renominated a senator named Thad Cochran, who's well known only for getting as much money from Washington to Mississippi and not much else, over a much more conservative candidate. My view, and we talked about this earlier, Stephen, is that the most wisdom was shown here by the black Democrats, who realized in a Republican state they can still play a pivotal role.
Right. It's very interesting. And there's been some cries of foul from McDaniel's campaign that Democrats were able to vote in what they call an open primary, mm-hmm. where you don't need to be a registered member of the Republican Party mm-hmm. to vote. But that's democracy, people using mm-hmm. their vote. I don't think that's necessarily ever a bad thing. I think the message from a lot of these primary elections that we've seen this year is incumbents better take care of their own backyard or they're going to get into trouble. You've mm-hmm. seen the Republicans that won in this time of deep antipathy towards Washington, people like Lindsey Graham in South Carolina, Mitch McConnell in Kentucky, realized early on that they had a big challenge and they need to do something about it. The big casualty was Eric Cantor, the former number two leader of the Republicans in the House of Representatives, who, as he would do in his job, goes around the country speaking at various events, raising money for Republicans, and didn't take care of his own mm-hmm. backyard mm-hmm. and lost a massive primary election. Thad Cochran was the same. You know, as you say, he was this kind of old school Southern gentleman senator that's been there for years, didn't realize he had a problem, and to some extent he was bailed out by the fact that there's a two-stage primary. The McDaniel, the challenger, didn't get the required 50% to beat him. So paradoxically, though, these Democrats that voted in this primary may have ended up helping the Republicans after November if they do win back the Senate, because they would provided Mitch McConnell, who mm-hmm. would be the leader, with a senator who's likely to hew to the leadership's line, whereas mm-hmm. McDaniel could have turned into one of these characters like Ted Cruz from Texas, who basically got to Washington 2 years ago and has been breaking furniture and infuriating the leadership ever since. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty fascinating, you know, domestic politics that's going on right now.
Chris McDaniel, if he'd won, I think would probably have won in Mississippi, which has become such a Republican state. But as I say, I was struck by how shrewdly the black Democrats, knowing it would be very hard to elect a Democrat mm-hmm. in Mississippi, and entered this primary. Cochran has gotten all the credit, but I think he doesn't deserve much. Barbara?
Well, I'm no expert on domestic politics, as you know. I just think it's interesting, though, that with all the hue and cry about the Tea Party and mm-hmm. their concerns about overspending in Washington and so on, the candidates who reliably get reelected are mm-hmm. those who, as we say, bring home the bacon. Mm-hmm. And Cochran bragged about all the federal mm-hmm. money that he mm-hmm. got for his state. And that used to be a badge of honor for any representative, mm-hmm. whether from the House or the Senate. And mm-hmm. the Tea Party sort of put mm-hmm. a bad odor on it. Mm-hmm. But clearly, if you do bring home resources for your people, mm-hmm. you have a better chance of being reelected. So I think it was a vote for sanity in this case.
What you just said about Cochran also applies to Mitch McConnell, mm-hmm. who's the minority leader in the Senate, who has bragged about all he's brought back to Kentucky, particularly the poor parts of Kentucky and in eastern Kentucky. And the thing I'll ask you about this, Stephen, is while Barbara makes a good point, while Republicans nationally talk about their goal is to reduce government and cut government spending, they do elect an awful lot of Republicans who don't pursue that.
Right, that's true. But it's also a case of that's the way these senators build power in their own constituencies. They climb up the tree, they use influence, they steer money back towards their state. Mm-hmm. The argument is also being used in Louisiana right now. Mary Landrieu, who's a very vulnerable Senate Democrat, has just ascended to the head of the Energy Committee in the Senate. The oil industry is massively important in Louisiana, and she's making the same argument. Don't get rid of me and replace me with some freshman Republican who's going to be the 100th most senior senator and mm-hmm. may have to wait 20 years to get into a position of any influence. It's one of the fascinating things about the U.S. political system. Senators and representatives are there for too long, sometimes become too Washington, they mm-hmm. lose touch with their district, and then they get kicked out. It's mm-hmm. it's the renewal of the political system in a way as well. So there's always this tension between Washington and the rest of the country. I've covered quite a few elections here, and I've never seen an election in which a candidate stands up and says, well, I'm Washington, vote for me. Barack Obama, the epitome of what Republicans see as Washington dysfunction mm-hmm. and overreach, ran the most successful anti-Washington campaign for years to get elected in 2008.
Mm-hmm. So it works.
It's a pretty good playbook.
Yeah, when there's no rule in politics, no matter how much of a bigwig you are in Washington, you have to show up at home, and Eric Cantor didn't and lost as a result. And Thad Cochran caught on to this just in time, I think, and started spending more time back in Mississippi. Well, finally, let's get to the issue that has concerned Republicans and conservatives, and that is that President Obama has said, look, I'm not going to deal with these Republicans in Congress anymore. I have a pen, and I can do a lot of things by executive authority, executive action. And he has changed deadlines in his health care program and changed immigration law and so on. Republicans, now they're going to file suit. What do you make of this, Stephen?
I mean, the counter to that argument is that the White House will say, well, it's not us that have not decided to work with Republicans. They've blocked everything we've tried to do since day one when we got here. So to some extent, it's a party thing, sort of issue here. The other issue is, you know, what exactly has the president done? The White House may have caused a rod for its own back in some ways by saying, well, I'm going to use my pen and my phone and I'm going to do all this. But if you actually look at what the president has done in terms of healthcare, immigration, some of these things are fairly small beer compared to what a president could do with a Congress that is agreeable. So I think there's that issue. And the other issue is, you know, John Boehner, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, is going to get a vote in the House to go ahead on a suit against the president, accusing him of not enforcing the laws that Congress has passed. As a practical matter, this will probably take months, if not years. The president's probably going to be long gone by the time there's any sort of the bill comes due with that. So I think it's the age-old tussle between the executive and the legislature, and it's been going on before, and it's going to go on as long as the republic survives, I guess.
I think so, but I think Stephen's right. There's been a fight between the president and Congress in a system of divided powers for years. Obama has particularly been explicit about what he's doing, that he's not going to deal with the Republicans, and indeed he's not. It means he doesn't have to negotiate or compromise. He can get as much as he wants out of executive power, and I'll have to say, so far, it's worked. Any case, that's all the time we have. Joining us today were Barbara Slavin, Washington correspondent for AlMonitor.com, and a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council South Asia Center, and Stephen Collinson, White House correspondent for Asia en France Press. This program was produced by Carol Castile. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Thanks for listening.
From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Issues in the News. You can email your questions or comments to our panelists. Send them to voanews@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune in the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us next week at this time for Issues in the News.